Think of the alternative. If news stories were written like mysteries with a dramatic payoff at the end, then readers who broke off in mid-story would miss the point. Imagine waiting until the last sentence of a story to find out who won the presidential election or the Super Bowl. The inverted pyramid also allows newspapers to get out the door on time. Suppose a late-breaking story forces editors to steal space from other stories. Without the inverted pyramid, they'd be forced to do a slow, careful editing job on all the other articles, trimming a word here or a phrase there. With the inverted pyramid structure, they simply lop off paragraphs from the bottom of the other articles, knowing that those paragraphs are, by construction, the least important. According to one account, perhaps apocryphal, the inverted pyramid arose during the Civil War. All the reporters wanted to use military telegraphs to transmit their stories back home, but they could be cut off at any moment. They might be bumped by military personnel, or the communication line might be lost completely, a common occurrence during battles. The reporters never knew how much time they would get to send a story, so they had to send the most important information first. Journalists obsess about their leads. Don Wycliffe, a winner of prizes for editorial writing, says, "I've always been a believer that if I've got 2 hours in which to write a story, the best investment I can make is to spend the first hour and 45 minutes of it getting a good lead, because after that, everything will come easily." So if finding a good lead makes everything else easy, why would a journalist ever fail to come up with one? A common mistake reporters make is that they get so steeped in the details that they fail to see the message's core, what readers will find important or interesting. The longtime newspaper writer Ed Cray, a professor of communications at the University of Southern California, has spent almost 30 years teaching journalism. He says, "The longer you work on a story, the more you can find yourself losing direction. No detail is too small. You just don't know what your story is anymore." The problem of losing direction, of missing the central story, is so common that journalists have given it its own name, burying the lead. Burying the lead occurs when the journalist lets the most important element of the story slip too far down in the story structure. The process of writing a lead and avoiding the temptation to bury it is a helpful metaphor for the process of finding the core. Finding the core and writing the lead both involve forced prioritization. Suppose you're a wartime reporter, and you can telegraph only one thing before the line gets cut. What would it be? There's only one lead, and there's only one core. You must choose. Forced prioritization is really painful. Smart people recognize the value of all the material. They see nuance, multiple perspectives, and because they fully appreciate the complexities of a situation, they're often tempted to linger there. This tendency to gravitate toward complexity is perpetually at war with the need to prioritize. This difficult quest, the need to wrestle priorities out of complexity, was exactly the situation that James Carville faced in the Clinton campaign of 1992. If you say three things, you don't say anything. A political campaign is a breeding ground of decision angst. If you think your organization has problems, imagine this challenge. You must build a nationwide organization from scratch, using primarily unpaid and largely unskilled workers. You've got about a year to pull the team together and line up an endless supply of donuts. Everyone in the organization needs to sing from the same hymnal, but you don't have much time to rehearse the choir, and the media prod you to sing a new song every day. To make matters worse, you must constantly contend with opponents who will seize on every errant word. Bill Clinton's 1992 campaign was a classic example of sticky ideas at work in a difficult environment. Not only did the campaign have the normal set of complexities, Clinton himself added a few new wrinkles. First, there were the bimbo eruptions, which need not to be re-examined here. Second, Clinton was a policy wonk by nature, which meant that he was inclined to pontificate on virtually every issue that he was asked about, instead of staying focused on a few key principles. As his key political advisor, James Carville had to cope with this complexity. One day, struggling to maintain his focus, he wrote three phrases on a whiteboard for all the campaign workers to see. One of the phrases on the impromptu list was, "It's the economy, stupid." This message would become the core of Clinton's successful campaign. The word stupid was added as a taunt to the campaign workers themselves, reminding them not to lose focus on what was important. "It was simple, and it was self-effacing," Carville explained. "I was trying to say, let's don't be too clever here. Don't come down here thinking we're too smart. Let's just remember the basics." The need for focus extended to Bill Clinton himself, perhaps especially to Clinton himself. At one point, Clinton was frustrated that he'd been advised to stop talking about balanced budgets, despite the fact that Ross Perot, the third-party candidate for president in 1992, was getting positive attention for his stand on the balanced budget. Clinton said, "I've been talking about these things for 2 years. Why should I stop talking about them now because Perot is in?" Clinton's advisors had to tell him, "There has to be message triage. If you say three things, you don't say anything." "It's the economy, stupid," was the lead of the Clinton story. And it was a good one. Because in 1992, the U.S. economy was mired in a recession. But if "it's the economy, stupid" is the lead, then the need for a balanced budget can't also be the lead. Carville had to stop Clinton from burying the lead. Decision paralysis. Why is prioritizing so difficult? In the abstract, it doesn't sound so tough. You prioritize important goals over less important goals. You prioritize goals that are critical ahead of goals that are beneficial. But what if you can't tell what's critical and what's beneficial? Sometimes it's not obvious. We often have to make decisions between one unknown and another. This kind of complexity can be paralyzing. In fact, psychologists have found that people can be driven to irrational decisions by too much complexity and uncertainty. In 1954, the economist L.J. Savage described what he perceived as a basic rule of human decision-making. He called it the sure thing principle. He illustrated it with this example. A businessman is thinking about buying a piece of property. There's an election coming up soon, and he initially thinks that its outcome could be relevant to the attractiveness of the purchase. So to clarify his decision, he thinks through both scenarios. If the Republican wins, he decides, he'll buy. If the Democrat wins, he'll do the same. Seeing that he'd buy in either scenario, he goes forward with a purchase despite not knowing the outcome. This decision seems sensible. Not many people would quibble with Savage's logic. Two psychologists quibbled. Amos Tversky and Eldar Shafir later published a paper proving that the sure thing principle wasn't always a sure thing. They uncovered situations where the mere existence of uncertainty seemed to alter how people made decisions, even when the uncertainty was irrelevant to the outcome, as with the businessman's purchase. For instance, imagine that you're in college and you've just completed an important final exam a couple of weeks before the Christmas holidays. You've been studying for this exam for weeks because it's in a subject that's important to your future career. You've got to wait 2 days to get the exam results back. Meanwhile, you see an opportunity to purchase a vacation during the holidays to Hawaii at a bargain basement price. Here are your three options. You can buy the vacation today, pass on it today, or pay a $5 fee to lock in the price for 2 days, which would allow you to make your decision after you got your grade. What would you do? You may feel some desire to know the outcome of your exam before you decide, as did the students who faced this choice in the original experiment. So Tversky and Shafir simply removed this uncertainty for two groups of participants. These groups were told up front how they did on the exam. Some students were told that they passed the exam, and 57% of them chose to go on the trip. After all, it makes for a good celebration. Other students were told that they failed the exam, and 54% of them chose to go on the trip. After all, it makes for a good recuperation. Both those who passed and those who failed wanted to go to Hawaii, pronto. Here's the twist. The group of students who, like you, didn't know their final exam results, behaved completely differently. The majority of them, 61%, paid $5 to wait for 2 days. Think about that. If you pass, you want to go to Hawaii. If you fail, you want to go to Hawaii. If you don't know whether you passed or failed, you wait and see. This is not the way the sure thing principle is supposed to behave. It's as if our businessman had decided to wait until after the election to buy his property, despite being willing to make the purchase regardless of the outcome. Tversky and Shafir's study shows us that uncertainty, even irrelevant uncertainty, can paralyze us. Another study, conducted by Shafir and a colleague, Donald Redelmeyer, demonstrates that paralysis can also be caused by choice. Imagine, for example, that you are in college and you face the following choice one evening. What would you do? 1. Attend a lecture by an author you admire who is visiting just for the evening, or 2. Go to the library and study. Studying doesn't look so attractive compared with a once-in-a-lifetime lecture. When this choice was given to actual college students, only 21% decided to study. Suppose instead you had been given 3 choices. 1. Attend the lecture. 2. Go to the library and study. 3. Watch a foreign film that you've been wanting to see. Does your answer differ? Remarkably, when a different group of students were given the 3 choices, 40% decided to study, double the number who did before. Giving students 2 good alternatives to studying, rather than 1, paradoxically makes them less likely to choose either. This behavior isn't rational, but it is human. Prioritization rescues people from the quicksand of decision angst, and that's why finding the core is so valuable. The people who listen to us will be constantly making decisions in an environment of uncertainty. They will suffer anxiety from the need to choose, even when the choice is between 2 good options, like the lecture and the foreign film. Core messages help people avoid bad choices by reminding them of what's important. In Herb Kelleher's parable, for instance, someone had to choose between chicken salad and no chicken salad, and the message, "the low-fare airline," led her to abandon the chicken salad. Idea clinics. The goal of this book is to help you make your ideas stick. So periodically throughout the book, we'll present idea clinics, which illustrate in practical terms how an idea can be made stickier. The clinics were inspired by the classic before and after photos used by weight loss centers, visible evidence that the diet works. Like patients trying a new diet, the initial ideas in the clinics vary in their need for change. Some need dramatic help, like a stomach stapling and liposuction, and some only need to lose a few pounds around the waistline. The point of the clinics is not to wow you with our creative genius, and it's fortunate for readers and authors alike that this is not the goal, because we are not creative geniuses. The point is simply to model the process of making ideas stickier. In contrast to traditional disclaimers, this is something you should try at home. Think about each message and consider how you would improve it using the principles in the book. You can safely skip the clinics. They are intended as sidebars to the text rather than as building blocks, but we hope you'll find them useful. Clinic. Warning. Sun exposure is dangerous. The situation. Health educators at Ohio State University want to inform the academic community about the risks of sun exposure. Message 1. Here's a web page with facts about sun exposure from Ohio State University. We've added numbers to each paragraph so that we can analyze the message later. Sun exposure. Precautions and protection. Paragraph 1. A golden bronze tan is often considered a status symbol. Perhaps this supports the idea that people who have time to lie in the sun long enough to develop a deep tan, or who can travel to warm climates during winter, have more money or leisure time than common folk. Nevertheless, the goal of many is a deep tan early in spring or to return from vacation with that hearty, healthy glow. Whether a tan suggests status or not, careless exposure to the sun can be harmful. Ultraviolet rays from the sun will damage skin, but can also create vision problems, allergic reactions, and depressed immune systems. Paragraph 2. Tanning and burning are caused by ultraviolet rays from the sun. These rays cannot be seen or felt, but penetrate the skin and stimulate cells containing a brownish pigment called melanin. Melanin protects the skin by absorbing and scattering ultraviolet rays. People with dark skins have high amounts of melanin, have greater natural protection from ultraviolet rays, and tan more easily. Blondes, redheads, and people with fair skins have less melanin, and therefore burn more quickly. Paragraph 3. As melanin is stimulated by ultraviolet rays, it rises to the skin's surface as a tan and provides protection against future sun exposure. Individuals with dark skins, such as olive, brown, or black, are not immune to burning and skin damage caused by careless exposure to the sun. Paragraph 4. Two types of ultraviolet rays, UV, from the sun exist, UVA and UVB. UVB cause burning of the skin, or the red associated with sunburn, skin cancer, and premature aging of skin. UVA rays stimulate tanning, but are also linked to other problems such as impaired vision, skin rashes, and allergic or other reactions to drugs. Paragraph 5. Skin damage from overexposure to the sun is cumulative over the years and cannot be reversed. Once damage occurs, it cannot be undone. Most serious and lasting damage occurs before age 18. Protection should start early, particularly with children who enjoy outdoor play on sunny days. Before you continue, go back and listen again to message 1. What can you do to improve it? Comments on message 1. What's the lead here? What's the core? The first paragraph dives into tanned skin as a status symbol, which is simply an interesting red herring. In fact, the text acknowledges as much when it says, whether a tan suggests status or not. To us, paragraph 5 flashes in neon lights as the core. Skin damage is cumulative over the years and cannot be reversed. Wow. Isn't that the single most important thing we'd want to tell sun worshippers? By contrast, paragraphs 2 through 4 provide superfluous mechanics. As an analogy, do smokers really need to understand the workings of the lungs in order to appreciate the dangers of smoking? Message 2. In the text below, we have reordered the points and tinkered with the prose a bit in the hope of unburying the lead. Sun exposure. How to get old prematurely. Paragraph 5. Skin damage from overexposure to the sun is like getting older. It is cumulative over the years and cannot be reversed. Once damage occurs, it cannot be undone. Most serious and lasting damage occurs before age 18. Fortunately, unlike aging, skin damage can be prevented. Sun protection should start early, particularly with children who enjoy playing outdoors on sunny days. Paragraphs 2, 3, and 4. Tanning and burning are caused by ultraviolet rays from the sun. Ultraviolet rays cause sunburn, which is a temporary sign of deeper underlying skin damage. Sunburns eventually disappear, but the underlying damage persists and may eventually cause premature aging or skin cancer. Paragraph 1. Ironically, a golden bronze tan is often considered a sign of good health. But ultraviolet rays not only damage skin, they can also create vision problems, allergic reactions, and depressed immune systems. So instead of a healthy tan, perhaps we should call it a sickly tan. Comments on message 2. The core of this message is that skin damage is cumulative and irreversible. So we've rewritten the message to stress that point and eliminate non-essential information. We've done this to illustrate the process of forced prioritization. We've had to eliminate some interesting stuff, such as the references to melanin, in order to let the core shine through. We've tried to emphasize the core in a couple of ways. First, we've unburied the lead, putting the core right up front. Second, we've added the analogy to aging to hammer home the idea that damage is irreversible. Third, we've added a concrete and perhaps unexpected image. Sunburns are a signal of damage. They may disappear, but the underlying damage does not. Punchline: avoid burying the lead. Don't start with something interesting but irrelevant in hopes of entertaining the audience. Instead, work to make the core message itself more interesting. Names, names, and names. Dunn, North Carolina is a small town about 40 miles south of Raleigh. It has 14,000 residents, and its workforce is primarily blue-collar. The local diner is packed in the morning with people eating big breakfasts and drinking coffee. Waitresses call you hun. The town recently got a Walmart. All in all, Dunn is a pretty normal place, except for one fact. Almost everyone there reads the local paper, the Daily Record. As a matter of fact, more than everyone in Dunn reads the paper. The Daily Record's penetration in the Dunn community is 112%, which is the highest penetration of any newspaper in the country. For a community penetration to exceed 100%, one of two things must be true. One, people from outside Dunn, perhaps people commuting to jobs in Dunn, are buying the paper. Or two, some households are buying more than one paper. Maybe it's hard for some couples in Dunn to share. What's the explanation for this remarkable success? The people of Dunn certainly have plenty of options for their news. USA Today, the Raleigh News and Observer, CNN, the Internet, and hundreds of other outlets. So why is the Daily Record so popular? The Dunn Daily Record was founded in 1950 by Hoover Adams. Adams was born with ink in his blood. He got his first byline by sending dispatches from his Boy Scout camp. By the time he was in high school, he was serving as a stringer, a freelance reporter, for the Raleigh paper. After World War II, Adams became the editor of the Dunn Dispatch. Eventually, he grew restless at the Dispatch and decided to start his own paper, the Daily Record. In 1978, after 28 years of head-to-head competition, the Dispatch finally gave up and sold out to him. Across the 55 years of his tenure as publisher, Adams has had a remarkably consistent editorial philosophy. He believes that newspapers should be relentlessly local in their coverage. In fact, he's a zealot about community coverage. In 1978, frustrated by what he felt was insufficient focus on local issues in the paper, he wrote a memo to his staff explaining his views. All of us know that the main reason anybody reads a local newspaper is for local names and pictures. That's the one thing we can do better than anybody else. And that's the thing our readers can't get anywhere else. Always remember, the mayor of Anger and the mayor of Lillington are just as important to those towns as the mayor of New York is to his people. Let's be clear. Adams' focus on local coverage is not a revolutionary sentiment. In fact, among publishers of small newspapers, it would be utterly uncontroversial. Yet it's easy enough to see that the idea has not become a reality at most papers. The average local newspaper is loaded with wire stories, analyses of pro sports teams, and spot photos with nary a person in sight. In other words, finding the core isn't synonymous with communicating the core. Top management can know what the priorities are, but be completely ineffective in sharing and achieving those priorities. Adams has managed to find and share the core. How did he do it? Sharing the core. Adams found the core of his newspaper operations, local focus. Then he turned his attention to sharing his core message, making it stick with his staff. For the rest of the chapter, in fact, the rest of the book, we will discuss ways to get core messages to stick. And we will start by studying the way Adams has made his local focus message stick. While many publishers pay lip service to the value of local focus, Adams is an extremist about it. he's willing to hurt the bottom line for local focus. The fact is, a local newspaper can never get enough local names. I'd happily hire two more typesetters and add two more pages in every edition of each paper if we had the names to fill them up. He's willing to be boring for local focus. I'll bet that if the Daily Record reprinted the entire Dunn telephone directory tonight, half the people would sit down and check it to be sure their name was included. When somebody tells you, "Oh, you don't want all those names," please assure them that's exactly what we want, most of all. He gleefully exaggerates in order to emphasize the value of local focus, quoting a saying of a friend, Ralph Delano, who runs the local paper in Benson. If an atomic bomb fell on Raleigh, it wouldn't be news in Benson unless some of the debris and ashes fell on Benson. In fact, asked why the Daily Record has been so successful, Adams replies, "It's because of three things: names, names, and names." What's going on here? Adams has found the core idea that he wants to communicate, that local focus is the key to his newspaper's success. That's step one. Step two is to communicate the core to others, and he does that brilliantly. Look at the techniques Adams uses to communicate his seriousness about local focus. He uses an analogy, comparing the mayor of Anger to the mayor of New York. We'll have more to say about analogy later in this chapter. He says he'd hire more typesetters if the reporters could generate enough names. This is forced prioritization. Local focus is more important than minimizing costs. Not a common sentiment among small-town papers. See the unexpected chapter. He also speaks in clear, tangible language. What does he want? Names. He wants lots of individual names in the newspaper every day. See the concrete chapter. This idea is concrete enough that everyone in the organization can comprehend and use it. Is there any room for misunderstanding? Is there a staffer who won't understand what Adams means by names? Names, names, and names is a simple statement that is symbolic of a core truth. It's not just that names are helpful. In Adams' mind, names trump costs. Names trump well-written prose. Names trump nuclear explosions in neighboring communities. For 55 years since Adams founded the paper, his core value of community focus has helped hundreds of people at the paper, in thousands of circumstances, make good decisions. As a publisher, Adams has presided over close to 20,000 issues, and each of those issues involved countless decisions. Which stories do we cover? What's important in the stories? Which photos do we run? Which do we cut out to save space? Adams can't possibly be personally involved in the vast majority of these hundreds of small decisions, but his employees don't suffer from decision paralysis because Adams' commander's intent is clear. Names, names, and names. Adams can't be everywhere, but by finding the core and communicating it clearly, he has made himself everywhere. That's the power of a sticky idea. Simple equals core plus compact. Adams is a clever wordsmith, but his most useful bit of wordplay is probably his least clever. Names, names, and names. This phrase is useful and memorable because it is highly concrete, but also because it is highly succinct. This example illustrates a second aspect of simplicity. Simple messages are core and compact. At one level, the idea of compactness is uncontroversial. Rarely will you get advice to make your communications lengthy and convoluted unless you write interest rate disclosures for a credit card company. We know that sentences are better than paragraphs. Two bullet points are better than five. Easy words are better than hard words. It's a bandwidth issue. The more we reduce the amount of information in an idea, the stickier it will be. But let's be clear. Compactness alone isn't enough. We could latch on to a compact message that isn't core. In other words, a pithy slogan that doesn't reflect our commander's intent. Compact messages may be sticky, but that says nothing about their worth. We can imagine compact messages that are lies. The earth is flat. compact messages that are irrelevant, goats like sprouts, and compact messages that are ill-advised. Never let a day pass without a shoe purchase. In other cases, compactness itself can come to seem an unworthy goal. Lots of us have expertise in particular areas. Becoming an expert in something means that we become more and more fascinated by nuance and complexity. That's when the curse of knowledge kicks in, and we start to forget what it's like not to know what we know. At that point, making something simple can seem like dumbing down. As an expert, we don't want to be accused of propagating sound bites or pandering to the lowest common denominator. Simplifying, we fear, can devolve into oversimplifying. So if we're going to define simple as core and compact, we need to assure ourselves that compactness is worth striving for. We've already got core. Why do we need compact? Aren't stripped-down ideas inherently less useful than fully elaborated ideas? Suppose we took compactness to its most extreme form. Is it possible to say something meaningful in the span of a soundbite? A bird in the hand. For thousands of years, people have exchanged soundbites called proverbs. Proverbs are simple yet profound. Cervantes defined proverbs as short sentences drawn from long experience. Take the English language proverb, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. What's the core? The core is a warning against giving up a sure thing for something speculative. The proverb is short and simple, yet it packs a big nugget of wisdom that is useful in many situations. As it turns out, this is not just an English language proverb. In Sweden, the saying is, rather one bird in the hand than 10 in the woods. In Spain, a bird in the hand is better than 100 flying birds. In Poland, a sparrow in your hand is better than a pigeon on the roof. In Russia, better a titmouse in the hand than a crane in the sky. Other variants can be found in Romanian, Italian, Portuguese, German, Icelandic, and even medieval Latin. The first documented case in English is from John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress in 1678. But the proverb may be much older still. In one of Aesop's fables, a hawk seizes a nightingale, who pleads for its life, arguing that it is too tiny a morsel to satisfy the hawk. The hawk replies, "I would be foolish to release the bird I have in my hand to pursue another bird that is not even in sight." This story dates from 570 BC. The bird-in-hand proverb, then, is an astoundingly sticky idea. It has survived for more than 2,500 years. It has spread across continents, cultures, and languages. Keep in mind that nobody funded a bird-in-hand advertising campaign. It spreads on its own. Many other proverbs share this longevity. In fact, a repertoire of proverbs has been found in almost every documented culture. Why? What is their purpose? Proverbs are helpful in guiding individual decisions in environments with shared standards. Those shared standards are often ethical or moral norms. Proverbs offer rules of thumb for the behavior of individuals. The golden rule, "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you," is so profound that it can influence a lifetime of behavior. The golden rule is a great symbol of what we're chasing in this chapter. Ideas that are compact enough to be sticky and meaningful enough to make a difference. Great simple ideas have an elegance and a utility that makes them function a lot like proverbs. Cervantes' definition of proverbs echoes our definition of simple ideas. Short sentences, compact. Drawn from long experience, core. We are right to be skeptical of soundbites because lots of soundbites are empty or misleading. They're compact without being core. But the simple we're chasing isn't a soundbite, it's a proverb. Compact and core. Adams managed to turn his core idea, the need to focus relentlessly on local issues, into a journalistic proverb. Names, names, and names is an idea that helps guide individual decision-making in a community of shared standards. If you're a photographer, the proverb has no value as a literal statement, unless you plan to shoot name tags. But when you know that your organization thrives on names, i.e., the specific actions taken by specific members of the local community, that knowledge informs the kinds of photo ops you look for. Do you shoot the boring committee deliberations or the gorgeous sunset over the park? Answer, the boring committee deliberations. Palm Pilot and the Visual Proverb. Compact ideas help people learn and remember a core message. But they may be even more important when it comes time to help people act properly, particularly in an environment where they have to make lots of choices. Why do remote controls have more buttons than we ever use? The answer starts with the noble intentions of engineers. Most technology and product design projects must combat feature creep, the tendency for things to become incrementally more complex until they no longer perform their original functions very well. A VCR is a case in point. Feature creep is an innocent process. An engineer looking at a prototype of a remote control might think to herself, hey, there's some extra real estate here on the face of the control, and there's some extra processing capacity on the chip. Rather than let it go to waste, what if we give people the ability to toggle between the Julian and the Gregorian calendars? The engineer is just trying to help, to add another gee whiz feature that will improve the remote control. The other engineers on the team, meanwhile, don't particularly care about the calendar toggle. Even if they think it's lame, they probably don't care enough to stage a protest. Either the calendar toggle button goes or I quit. In this way, slowly and quietly, remote controls, and by extension other types of technologies, are featured to death. The Palm Pilot team, aware of this danger, took a hard line against feature creep. When the team began its work in the early 1990s, personal digital assistants, PDAs, had an unblemished record of failure. Apple's famous debacle with its Newton PDA had made other competitors gun-shy. One of the competitors on the PDA market in 1994 looked like a malnourished computer. It was a bulky device with a keyboard and multiple ports for peripherals. Jeff Hawkins, the Palm Pilot team leader, was determined that his product would avoid this fate. He wanted the Palm Pilot to be simple. It would handle four things: calendars, contacts, memos, and task lists. The Palm Pilot would do only four things, but it would do them well. Hawkins fought feature creep by carrying around a wooden block the size of the palm. Trey Vasallo, a member of the Palm 5 design team, says, "The block was dumb, which resonated with the simple technological goals of the product, but it was also small, which made the product elegant and different." Hawkins would pull out the wooden block to take notes during a meeting or check his calendar in the hallway. Whenever someone suggested another feature, Hawkins would pull out the wooden block and ask them where it would fit. Vasallo said that the Palm Pilot became a successful product almost because it was defined more in terms of what it was not than in terms of what it was. Tom Kelly from IDEO, a prominent Silicon Valley design firm, made a similar point. The real barrier to the initial PDAs was the idea that the machine had to do nearly everything. Hawkins knew that the core idea of his project needed to be elegance and simplicity, and a tenacious avoidance of feature creep. In sharing this core idea, Hawkins and his team used what was in essence a visual proverb. The block of wood became a visual reminder to do a few things and do them well. There is a striking parallel between the development of the Palm Pilot and the Clinton campaign led by James Carville. In both cases, the teams were composed of people who were knowledgeable and passionate about their work. Both teams boasted plenty of people who had the capability and the desire to do a lot of different things, argue every issue and engineer every feature. Yet in both cases, the team needed a simple reminder to fight the temptation to do too much. When you say three things, you say nothing. When your remote control has 50 buttons, you can't change the channel anymore. Using what's there. Our messages have to be compact because we can learn and remember only so much information at once. But suppose we've assessed the core of our message and we have too much information to aspire to the compactness of a proverb. How do we convey lots of information when we need to? The following exercise is designed to reinforce the need for compactness and to provide a hint about how to cram more information into a compact message. Here are the rules of this exercise. Listen to the following letters. Then hit pause. Pull out a sheet of paper and write down as many letters as you can remember. Here are the letters. J, F, K, F, B, I, N, A, T, O, U, P, S, N, A, S, A, I, R, S. If you're like most people, you probably remembered about 7 to 10 letters. That's not much information. Compactness is essential because there's a limit to the amount of information we can juggle at once. Now, try the exercise again. There's a twist this time. We haven't changed the letters or the sequence. All we've done is change the way the letters are grouped. Once again, listen to the letters and press pause. Here are the letters. J, F, K, F, B, I, N, A, T, O, U, P, S, N, A, S, A, I, R, S. Chances are you did much better the second time. Suddenly, the letters meant something, which made them easier to remember. In round one, you were trying to remember raw data. In round two, you were remembering concepts. John F. Kennedy, the FBI, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, UPS, NASA, the IRS. But wait a second. Why is it easier to remember John F. Kennedy than the random letters FJK? Surely John F. Kennedy is a bigger bundle of information than the three random letters. Think of all the associations with JFK. Politics, relationships, his assassination, and his famous family. If remembering was like weightlifting, it would be ridiculous to think we could lift JFK easier than three little letters. The secret, of course, is that we're not lifting JFK. All the remembering work related to JFK has already been done. We've already built those muscles. The concept of JFK and all its associations is already embedded in our memories. What we're remembering is simply a pointer to this information. We're posting a little flag on the terrain of our memory. With the raw letters, we're posting three separate flags. In the end, it's one bit of information, or one flag, versus three. And it's no surprise that one is easier to remember. So what? Is this just neat brain trivia? Here's where we're going. We've seen that compact ideas are stickier, but that compact ideas alone aren't valuable. Only ideas with profound compactness are valuable. So to make a profound idea compact, you've got to pack a lot of meaning into a little bit of messaging. And how do you do that? You use flags. You tap the existing memory terrain of your audience. You use what's already there. The Pomelo Schema. So far, we have presented situations in which one simple idea, or a handful of simple ideas, were useful in guiding behavior. But let's face it, most people in the world do complicated things. It's not our intention to argue that complicated things, law, medicine, construction, programming, teaching, can be pared down to two or three compact messages. We obviously can't replace a school of architecture with a single compact idea. Keep the building from falling down. This leads us to an important issue that we haven't discussed yet. How do you turn a freshman into an architect? How does complexity emerge from simplicity? We will argue that it is possible to create complexity through the artful use of simplicity. If simple ideas are staged and layered correctly, they can very quickly become complex. Let us teach you what a pomelo is. If you already know what a pomelo is, be a good sport and feign ignorance. Here is one way that we can explain to you what a pomelo is. Explanation 1. A pomelo is the largest citrus fruit. The rind is very thick but soft and easy to peel away. The resulting fruit has a light yellow to coral pink flesh and can vary from juicy to slightly dry and from seductively spicy sweet to tangy and tart. Quick question. Based on this explanation, if you mixed pomelo juice half and half with orange juice, would it taste good? You might make a guess, but the answer is probably a bit ambiguous. Let's move on to an alternative explanation. Explanation 2. A pomelo is basically a supersized grapefruit with a very thick and soft rind. Explanation 2 sticks a flag on a concept that you already know, a grapefruit. When we tell you that a pomelo is like a grapefruit, you call up a mental image of a grapefruit. Then we tell you what to change about it. It's supersized. Your visualized grapefruit grows accordingly. We've made it easier for you to learn a new concept by tying it to a concept that you already know. In this case, the concept is grapefruit. Grapefruit is a schema that you already have. Schema is a bit of technical jargon from psychology, but it's so useful that we think it's worth carrying through the book. Psychologists define schema as a collection of generic properties of a concept or category. Schemas consist of lots of pre-recorded information stored in our memories. If someone tells you that she saw a great new sports car, a picture immediately springs to mind, filled with generic properties. You know what sports cars are like. You picture something small and two-door with a convertible top, perhaps. If the car in your picture moves, it moves fast. Its color is almost certainly red. Similarly, your schema of grapefruit also contains a cluster of generic properties. Yellow-pink color, tart flavor, softball-sized, and so on. By calling up your grapefruit schema, we were able to teach you the concept of pomelo much faster than if we had mechanically listed all the attributes of a pomelo. Note, too, that it's easier to answer the question about the blend of pomelo and orange juice. You know that grapefruit juice blends well with OJ, so the pomelo schema inherits this property from the grapefruit schema. By the way, to be complete, explanation 1 is itself full of schemas. Citrus fruit is a schema, rind is a schema, and tangy is a schema. Explanation 2 is easier to parse only because grapefruit is a higher level schema, a schema composed of other schemas. By using schemas, explanation 2 improves both our comprehension and our memory. Let's think about the two definitions of pomelo in terms of the inverted pyramid structure. What's the lead? Well, with explanation 1, the lead is citrus fruit. After the lead, there is no clear hierarchy. Depending on what catches people's attention, they might remember the rind info, very thick but soft and easy to peel away, or the color info, light yellow to coral pink, or the juiciness info, or the taste info. With explanation 2, the lead is grapefruit-like. The second paragraph is supersized. The third paragraph is very thick and soft rind. 6 months from now, people will remember at best the lead of our story. That means that with one story, they'd remember fruit or citrus fruit. With the other story, they'd remember grapefruit. The second story is clearly better. It isn't a judgment call. This concludes what will probably be the last psychological discussion of citrus fruit you'll ever encounter. But though the concept of pomelo may not be worth the neurons you just burned on it, the underlying concept that schemas enable profound simplicity is critical. Good teachers intuitively use lots of schemas. Economics teachers, for instance, start with compact, stripped-down examples that can be understood by students who have no pre-existing economic schemas. Let's say that you grow apples and I grow oranges. where the only two people are around. Let's also say that we'd prefer to eat some of both fruits rather than all of either. Should we trade? If so, how do we go about doing it? Students are initially taught how trade works in this simplified context. This knowledge in turn becomes a basic trade schema for them. Once learned, this schema can be called up and stretched along some dimension. For example, what happens if you suddenly get better at growing apples? Do we still trade the same way we did before? To solve this problem, we're calling up a schema and adapting it, just as we did in making a pomelo out of our grapefruit schema. Complexity from simplicity. Schemas help us create complex messages from simple materials. In school, lots of science courses are taught by clever uses of schemas. Introductory physics deals with simple idealized situations. Pulleys, inclines, objects moving at constant rates along frictionless paths. As students become familiar with the pulley schema, it can be stretched in some way or merged with other schemas to solve more complicated problems. Another nice use of a schema is the solar system model of the atom, which many of us were taught as kids. This model posits that electrons orbit the nucleus, much as planets orbit the sun. This analogy gives students a quick, compact insight into how the atom works. The planetary analogy also provides an insight into the reason that many people avoid compact schemas. A supersized grapefruit, in favor of exhaustive description. A citrus fruit with a soft, thick rind, blah, blah, blah. The use of schemas can sometimes involve a somewhat slower route to the real truth. For instance, physicists now know that electrons don't orbit the nucleus the way that planets do. In reality, electrons move in probability clouds. So, what do you tell a sixth grader? Do you talk about the motion of planets, which is easy to understand and nudges you closer to the truth? Or do you talk about probability clouds, which are impossible to understand but accurate? The choice may seem to be a difficult one. 1. Accuracy first, at the expense of accessibility. Or 2. Accessibility first, at the expense of accuracy. But in many circumstances, this is a false choice for one compelling reason. If a message can't be used to make predictions or decisions, it is without value, no matter how accurate or comprehensive it is. Herb Kelleher could tell a flight attendant that her goal is to maximize shareholder value. In some sense, this statement is more accurate and complete than that the goal is to be the low-fare airline. After all, the proverb, the low-fare airline, is clearly incomplete. Southwest could offer lower fares by eliminating aircraft maintenance or by asking passengers to share napkins. Clearly, there are additional values, customer comfort, safety ratings, that refine Southwest's core value of economy. The problem with maximized shareholder value, despite its accuracy, is that it doesn't help the flight attendant decide whether to serve chicken salad. An accurate but useless idea is still useless. We discussed the curse of knowledge in the introduction, the difficulty of remembering what it was like not to know something. Accuracy to the point of uselessness is a symptom of the curse of knowledge. To a CEO, maximizing shareholder value may be an immensely useful rule of behavior. To a flight attendant, it's not. To a physicist, probability clouds are fascinating phenomena. To a child, they are incomprehensible. People are tempted to tell you everything with perfect accuracy right up front, when they should be giving you just enough info to be useful, then a little more, then a little more. Schemas in Hollywood. High-concept pitches. A great way to avoid useless accuracy and to dodge the curse of knowledge is to use analogies. Analogies derive their power from schemas. A pomelo is like a grapefruit. A good news story is structured like an inverted pyramid. Skin damage is like aging. Analogies make it possible to understand the compact message because they invoke concepts that you already know. A good analogy can wield a lot of power. In fact, in Hollywood, $100 million movies can be greenlighted based largely on the strength of a one-sentence analogy. The average Hollywood studio considers hundreds of pitches or screenplays for every movie it makes. It may be hard to muster sympathy for the life of studio execs, but let's try for a moment. Imagine the terrifying decisions they must make. When they invest in a movie, they are essentially betting millions of dollars and their own reputations on an intangible idea. Contrast a movie pitch with the blueprint for a home. If an architect creates a nifty blueprint for a home and someone puts up the money for construction, you can feel pretty confident that 9 months later, you'll have a home that realizes the architect's original vision. A movie pitch, on the other hand, is destined to change. When a screenwriter is hired, the story will change. When a director is hired, the artistic feel of the movie will change. When stars are hired to play the parts, their personalities will change how we perceive the characters in the story. When producers are hired, the storytelling will become subject to financial and logistical constraints. And when the movie is completed, months or years later, the marketing team will need to find a way to explain the plot to the public in about 30 seconds, without giving away too much. Imagine investing millions in an idea that will change as it is filtered through the consciousness of a succession of individuals with giant egos, directors, stars, producers, marketers. That idea had better be good. In Hollywood, people use core ideas called high-concept pitches. You've probably heard some of them. Speed was Die Hard on a bus. 13 Going on 30 was Big for girls. Alien was Jaws on a spaceship. The high-concept pitches don't always reference other movies. E.T., for instance, was pitched as Lost Alien Befriends Lonely Boy to Get Home. But a lot of pitches do invoke past movies. Why is that? Is it because Hollywood is full of cynical execs who shamelessly recycle old ideas? Well, yes, but that's only part of the reason. The concept of the movie Speed, before it was pitched, obviously did not exist in the minds of the execs. It was like the word pomelo before you knew what it meant. The compact five-word phrase, Die Hard on a bus, pours a breathtaking amount of meaning into the previously non-existent concept of speed. To see this, think of all the important decisions you could make just on the strength of those five words. Do you hire an action director or an indie director? Action. Do you budget $10 million for the movie or $100 million? $100 million. Big star or ensemble cast? Big star. Target a summer release or a Christmas release? Summer. As another example, imagine that you were just hired to be the production designer on the new film Alien. It will be your job to design the spaceship where most of the movie takes place. What does it look like? If you knew nothing at all about the movie, you might sensibly start by looking at old spaceship designs. For instance, think of the cool, immaculate interior of the Enterprise on Star Trek. Then your boss tells you that the vision for the movie is Jaws on a spaceship. That changes everything. Jaws was not cool or immaculate. Richard Dreyfuss navigated around on a rickety old boat. Decisions were rushed, slapdash, claustrophobic, anxiety-ridden. The environment was sweaty. As you think about what made Jaws tick, your ideas start to take shape. The ship will be underdeveloped, dingy, and depressive. The crew members will not wear bright Lycra uniforms. The rooms will not be well-lit and lintless. High-concept pitches are Hollywood's version of core proverbs. Like most proverbs, they tap the power of analogy. By invoking schemas that already exist, e.g., what the movie Jaws is like, the proverbs radically accelerate the learning process for people working on a brand new movie. Obviously, a good pitch is not synonymous with a good movie. Jaws on a spaceship could have turned into a terrible movie if it weren't for the contributions of hundreds of talented people over a period of years. On the other hand, A bad pitch, a bad proverb, is plenty to ruin a movie. No director could save Terms of Endearment on a spaceship. If high-concept pitches can have this power in the movie world, an environment filled with 40 times the normal density